gentlemen, you can't fight in here. This is the war room.
Fine, I can hear you now, Dimitri. Clear and plain and coming through fine. I'm coming through fine too, eh? Good, then. Well, then, as you say, we're both coming through fine. Good. Well, it's good that you're fine and I'm fine. I agree with you. It's great to be fine.
It's a podcast.
Hello, and welcome to Fighting in the War Room, episode 2, the review segment for Friday, December 6, 2013. This week, we are traveling to Greenwich Village with a cat under our arms as we review Inside Llewyn Davis, the new film from the Coen brothers. And we brought in, we've filled our David quota this time. We have both David Ehrlich with us, and then special guest David Fear. Thank you for joining us.
You're welcome. It's a double the David week.
I know. It's going to get very confusing because usually we have Dave and David, and I don't know what we're going to start calling you, but we'll
figure. I will answer to Dave, although I should just call both of us double D's.
How about just Mr. Fear?
It sounds like Smaug.
Mr. Yeah. Fear?
I thought you were going to say that was your father's name. David Fear, when we asked you to review this with us, you said you would have been just standing on a street corner muttering about it to yourself anyway if you hadn't been brought on a podcast. So I want to let you start talking first since you are apparently the number one champion of this movie. Did you see it at Cannes? Were you an early adopter, or when did you get on board with this movie?
No, I skipped Cannes this year, so I didn't see it until it screened for the New York Film Festival. But I guess you could say I was an early adopter in that I've been a fan of that musical scene for a long time. Like most people, I sort of discovered it through those early Dylan years, and then it becomes the gateway drug where you start going, oh, who's Dave Von Ronk?
I was about to say, are you a Dave Von Ronk fan?
Yeah, I mean, he's one of those guys that you are like, wow, it was crucial to that scene. And then actually hearing some of the songs in this movie, a couple of these songs are Dave Von Ronk songs, and the songs that aren't sound like they could have been written by him. I'm starting to appreciate his stuff more. I've actually kind of gone back and listened to a few of those songs. I mean, this film's on my year-end list. This film, I'm a huge Coen Brothers fan as well. I just think this is such a really wonderful, beautiful, gentle ode to failure. And I don't think that's a movie that a lot of people are able to do, especially when you're, you know, alleged misanthropes the way that the Coen brothers are. They have a tendency to come off as really hating their characters or really feeling like they have to kind of just turn them on the spit. And there's something, they don't let Llewyn Davis off very easily, to say the least. He's a folk singer who is exactly one giant step behind a major cultural curve. He's the Job of McDougal Street in the early 60s. And he's this talented guy who's just in the right place at the exact wrong time. But I think it's the way they kind of portray that failure that he becomes, that betray him not really making it the way he should be making it, because he's clearly talented, that I think is really funny and beautiful and great and so exemplary of what the Coen brothers do better than I think just about anybody else.
Now, I don't know that much about Dave Von Ronk, but I know for a while people thought this was going to be a biopic of him, but he, like Llewyn Davis, who is fictional, was a folk singer in the 60s, the scene that birthed Bob Dylan, but never became famous. And we watched Llewyn Davis kind of basically self-sabotage his way toward failing to break it big. Like, it's almost less like it's bad timing, and he just doesn't understand. He can't manage to make himself actually succeed. Is there anything, like, biographically about Dave Von Ronk that helps for seeing this, or is it, I mean, I didn't know anything. I enjoyed the hell out of the movie, so I assume there's not too much I'm missing.
Yeah, I think if you've read, like, The Mayor of McDougal Street, which is very much about Dave Von Ronk in that scene, or positively Fourth Street, which is a great, if you don't know anything about the early 60s Greenwich Village folk scene, both pre- and post-Dylan, pick up positively Fourth Street. It's a really great survey. I can't remember the author's name off the top of my head, but it's really wonderful, and you should run to your local independent bookstore and buy a new copy. Not a used copy, a new copy. But no, I don't think you need to be steeped in that culture or even really love the music the way that a lot of people who are getting behind this movie love the music to kind of appreciate Oscar Isaac's performance, which is amazing, to appreciate the attention to detail, to appreciate the recreation and of the atmosphere, not just the environment of the early 60s in Greenwich Village, but the kind of atmosphere that was going on, the weird sort of like beatnik beard boho thing. I think that if you like the Coen brothers films and you appreciate their sense of humor and you understand that they can do pathos well, these guys do have hearts. They're not just, you know, their chest cavities aren't just filled with coal, nuggets of coal. that I think you will like this film. I think it's just really, really beautifully done. And even
Would you say that even more so than most Coen Brothers films, that this is a Coen Brothers film for Coen Brothers fans?
No, because I think that I don't think you need to be a fan to appreciate this film the way I think you really need to be a Coen Brothers fan to appreciate Barton Fink, which is maybe my favorite Coen Brothers film, or really be a Coen Brothers fan to appreciate, oh gosh, I don't know.
A Serious Man was going to be my example.
See, I think appreciating Barton Fink makes you a Coen Brothers fan.
What's that?
I think appreciating Barton Fink is what makes you a Coen Brothers fan.
Yes, almost to the exclusion of everything else. It's almost like you've been branded.
But yeah. this movie seems to have such a different rhythm than a lot of their other works.
Do we want to set it up a little bit more about the plot, so to speak?
Sure. I mean, you know,
there isn't too much to say, but
yeah. Not much happens.
So, I mean, for those who are completely unfamiliar, I mean, it's essentially the portrait of a week in the life of this guy, who's sort of like this fictionalization of Dave Van Ronk, who's named Llewyn Davis, as you may have gleaned from the title, played by Oscar Isaac, as he sort of kicks around East Village and beyond and looks for a place to sleep and is sort of he's sort of in the immediate wake of a personal tragedy, which we learn about as the movie goes on. And he has some poorly communicated, not to in the film, but between the characters, dealings with Carey Mulligan's character, who is currently dating Justin Timberlake's character, all of whom are connected in the folk scene. I don't know if that was helpful at all, but
yeah,
Carey Mulligan and Justin Timberlake, I should mention, are in this very kind of Peter, Paul, and Mary trio. There are a lot of like sort of in jokes about the folk scene if you know it there. But again, you don't need to know these to kind of appreciate it or appreciate how wonderful Carey Mulligan can swear.
Oh, yeah,
that's true.
And how great she looks in that wig.
Yeah, she actually does look great in this kind of the Peter, Paul and Mary. She's got the Mary long hair. And she even does. If you watch the scene with the three, it's her, Justin Timberlake. And I can't remember the guy's
Stark
name.
Stark Sands. Yeah.
Thank you. Stark Sands is great in this as well. When the three of them are standing up there, they almost like are perfectly replicating a Peter, Paul, and Mary cover.
So oh, really? Really,
yeah.
Patches, jump in on this. You were going to start talking.
Well, I think I was going to say that speaking to the loving Coen Brothers movies point that I do. I mean, I'm a huge Coen Brothers fan, and that this really took me unexpectedly because it doesn't have the same rhythm as those past movies. And I was expecting something else, honestly. I was expecting something like Oh Brother, Where Art Thou? Kind of this odyssey through the folk scene. And it wasn't like that. I mean, it kind of gracefully wanders into the folk scene every once in a while, but this is really about a down-on-his-luck artist struggling in New York, and the background scenery lives and breathes the folk scene, but this is, I feel like it's detached. It's certainly not an exploration of this musical moment in time. Or maybe it is on another level, and that's really not something that I connect with personally, because obviously the music is beautiful. But for me, this is really just about how art can keep you persisting through the worst times in life.
I mean,
and why you can still find sweetness and love in these moments and beauty, and when it can be so down. Like, it is interesting to me to see people kind of reacting like, why do the Coen brothers hate their characters so much? I don't find any hate in this movie, or I don't find any like playing with Llewyn Davis in this movie. They're not toying with him. I mean, he does suffer from Murphy's Law, but it's certainly about his persistence. Yeah, I mean, it's his own problem as an artist.
But he doesn't have, I mean, I think what's interesting about Llewyn Davis, and I really think for me this movie resonated as a portrait of loneliness, and not purely in the negative way that implies, but sort of just what it is to be alone, and even when you are in sort of these very serious relationships, or meaningful, not relationships, but connections with other people, like his whatever he has happening with Carey Mulligan's character, how it's possible to still feel alone and how artistic expression plays a part in that. It really reminded me of Under the Skin, the Jonathan Glazer film.
That no one's seen yet. Oh, I'm glad I reminded you of that.
You were on a streak, David.
Sorry. No, but it is, you know, worth noting. If anyone else has seen
it. It reminded me of what it must have been like to be the Coen brothers after Intolerable Cruelty and Lady Killers. I mean, so alone in the world, but persisting artistically.
But those films are such hermetic, formalist exercises in misanthropy, and like, this to me just feels actually very affectionate. It actually, the rhythms of it reminds me a lot of Fargo.
Yeah.
And that you never feel like they're talking down to Marge, and yet they're putting Marge in these horrible situations around these people that you're never sure whether you're supposed to be kind of laughing at or feeling affectionate for. And in the end, you end up kind of, her character sort of like tugs you through this environment in the same way that I feel Lewin, despite really being his worst enemy, kind of tugs you through this environment. And I think your point, David, about loneliness is interesting, because in a way it really is about like what happens when you follow that artistic impulse down a wormhole.
Mm.
And you just take it as far as you can to the point where you end up becoming an asshole and alienating everyone around you, even if you're talented and no one seems to notice it.
But I think the fact that Lewin is very talented, I mean, I think as you, anyone who's listened to the soundtrack can tell you, I think it's an accurate representation of how great the music that he plays in the film is. He also, I think that his sort of downward trajectory, his isolationism, is his art in some respect. I think he doesn't have the gene to become a Bob Dylan type, to become even in this film the Justin Timberlake type. I think that he is not only his worst enemy, but I think he's also sort of engineered this way. Not that he just has bad luck, but that this particular trajectory suits his personality.
He can't help but be snobby.
Right.
Yeah. Or he can't help but, you know, lash out when, in the back moment when he's not supposed to lash out.
Yeah.
And there's
David, you must have related to this film quite a bit.
There's something about, like, when I saw this movie, I saw it with a couple people who kind of weren't that into it because they're, you know, they saw it as this movie about this guy who, this, you know, guy trying, failing to make his way through the world, and why do we need another story about this kind of guy? But what I like, the self-sabotaging nature of it. I feel like that's the thing that you see in people in real life that you don't see in movies that often. And it is a really interesting twist on that Coen's idea of fate beating people down, where it's this self-imposed fate and this self-imposed disaster, where then you see someone like, I think what they do with the Stark Sands character is really interesting, where he introduces this kind of yokel who shows up in the apartment and has this crazy voice. And then you see that he's really nice and really talented, and he's getting places because he's nice and talented. You see the world the way it's supposed to work, and then you see Lewin kind of failing to connect with
that. Well, Lewin almost made it in the scene. He had a partner who he's making albums with, and he was garnering some fame, and then catastrophe.
I wouldn't say what happened.
I won't say what happened, but I mean, you could understand why someone would retreat from that forever if something like that happened, which is interesting.
The structure of the film is so – I mean, so many of the Coen brothers' films, particularly in the latter half of the career, feel vaguely Homeric and how they operate is somewhere between Homer and the Book of Job. But the structure of Inside Llewyn Davis doesn't become entirely clear until the very end of the movie, and I will not say more about the particulars of that. But there is something about how that happens that really takes all these loose ends and sort of eccentric characters and coheres them into this sort of overwhelmingly beautiful experience. And it's that the movie's greatest moment of defeat and sadness, and yet at the same time, sort of what we were talking about earlier, is also when I felt that the film was just so ineffably beautiful in that moment. And I think it's how not that the Coens just marry the two, but actually discover one of those feelings through the other is what makes this so memorable. And for me, I think of all the films that I've seen this year, even if this isn't necessarily my number one favorite, I feel strongly that this, more than any other film I saw in 2013, will be a film that I revisit time and time and time again, like an old folk song in a way.
Talking about the scope of this film is really interesting, because you're right. Like I mentioned, I was expecting something that was like an odyssey, you know, going on an adventure through this scene. But even when he starts journeying, you know, he gets in a car with John Goodman and Garrett Hudlund, and it still doesn't feel like an adventure. It doesn't feel like a road movie. It feels very intimate. And it's always, we're always with Lewin through this whole journey. And I wonder what creates that intimacy. I mean, I guess it's the script, it's the storytelling, it's the conversational aspect as opposed to the going out, whereas Oh Brother, Where Art Thou is literally they're on the run. Here is a movie of conversations and little moments, and I think the photography really does something for me in this film.
I think the music does quite a bit as well, too.
Mm-hmm.
Earlier this week, we were talking about Harry Potter and the Half-Blood Prince, And this movie was shot by the same guy who did that movie, Bruno Del Bono. And I don't know what... I know this movie was shot on film, but the blooming in this movie, I don't know how they achieve this. I'm so fascinated. But this warmth to the whole picture, even though we're kind of in greens and blues and this coldness and it's this sadness that runs through the whole thing, it's such an interesting dynamic to have such a sad palette, but that there's really sweet.
I don't know if warm is the word.
What I'm trying to say is it has this interesting dichotomy that the color palette is cold and sad, and yet it's blooming like warmth, and I get that from the picture itself.
It's warm the way that an old photograph feels warm.
Sure, yes.
I mean, for me, the image has a softness to it, which you can see pretty clearly in the trailers, which I thought at first was sort of just low resolution, but when you see it in, you know, projected on the big screen, you understand as this general softness. But there's also a bitter chill to it, which is, you know, sort of perfect for the story, which I felt really in my bones. I think I watched the entire movie with my jacket on. And
we've all walked through this New York winter.
No, it looks like what it feels like to be cold. You know, you get that feeling when you're walking home by yourself.
The last time I felt so cold watching a movie was like a Satin Tango by Pale Atar. I mean, it really, it's like in your bones. And it so gets you into his bitter state of mind that I think there's not really much of a leap you have to make when you see the way that he's interacting with Carey Mulligan's character or his dad who he visits in one scene or anyone else.
It's like the Satan Tango of folk music. I smell a tagline here.
He's going to be on the poster.
CBS Films.
Do you guys want to say anything in specific about, when we mentioned that the music is really good, is there anything about the music in particular that, you know, if people have listened to the soundtrack already, is there something that you can't get from just listening to that comes out in the movie?
I think it's contextualized by characters. I mean, this isn't just plucking famous songs or semi-famous songs or songs that feel from the era and dropping them in. Again, this is all an extension of these characters and where they're coming for. The performance between Justin Timberlake and Carey Mulligan and Stark Sands that David was describing earlier is such perfect cheekiness. Like, you can feel Lewin rubbing against that performance, or it's like suffocating the room for him while everyone else can enjoy themselves. And that's such a, like, they keep going back to this club that he plays in. And
it also functions as a plot point too, especially the look that is exchanged between someone who's on stage and someone in the audience.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And it's interesting too. A lot of the Twitter conversations revolved around this song, "Please, Mr. Kennedy," that Lewin sings with Timberlake and Adam Driver. And it's a very funny moment in the script, but it's also about like how easily Lewin Davis can slip into this. He can be a manufactured product of the folk scene. And while it's really funny, it kind of cripples him. I mean, it angers him so, and yet he can slip so easily into it. I think the music really stretches these characters in an interesting way.
I was on board.
There's go ahead, David.
I was just going to say, the movie opens with an extended long take of Oscar Isaac's performing the song Hang Me. If you're not into it by then, there may be no hope for you, because it's such a gripping, you know, it so perfectly sets the stage for everything that's to come and the tenor of the movie to follow.
It's a great performance by Oscar Isaac, that whole scene that he does. And yeah, it's a great way to start a movie. He also, there's a scene later when he's in a club in Chicago, when it could very well be his big break, that he sings this extraordinary ballad that could have very well been off like Bob Dylan's third or fourth album. You really feel too, like you're like, oh my God, this guy could be like a Dylan, like of Dylan caliber, the way he's singing the song, the way he's using this wordplay and how he's playing it. And then it ends with this wonderful defeating line. And to me, like, that really becomes the crux of when the performance of the music and the performance of the actor and how this guy, this character is performing and then just not getting anywhere. I mean, it's just becomes this beautiful mocha swirl of cinema right there. Yeah. To me, that's why you can't separate the music from the film.
Yeah, it is really, it's not, I've only listened to the soundtrack after I'd seen the movie, but it is weird to imagine people listening to the soundtrack extensively before seeing it, which is why I guess it's a good thing that it's opening.
I don't know.
Now.
Listening to you, Miss. Are we cutting it off there? Or are we still going?
No, you can.
I was going to say, listening to you, Mr. Fear, talk about that great scene with F. Murray Abraham.
Oh, so good.
It's it. Maybe, you know, I wanted to toss out my my Homer and Job, and it's really more Sisyphus than anything else. Just thinking of him, you know, traveling halfway across the country and just killing this song in front of F. Murray Abraham, who has a character who has the power to make, you know, Llewyn Davis happen, and just being coldly shut down. And the ride back to New York that follows. I mean,
sleeping on a school bus.
It's so good.
Well, it's so universally. That feeling is so universal. Anyone who's done anything remotely artistic has felt that rejection, I think, in some point in their lives. And even though it's very specific to the film, it plays so grandly.
Yeah, it's loneliness, rejection, chasing cats. I mean, these are all universal themes.
Yes.
Amazing cat photography.
Amazing cat photography. Amazing cat performance. Just like all around that cat. And the name is so worth keeping. I don't think I thought about it before releasing it, before it came out, why the cat was nameless, but it's worth it. Just
definitely pertinent to our conversation here. But
the only thing I don't like about this movie is that the cat doesn't have a line, so he's not eligible for a SAG card.
And he won't even be included in the SAG ensemble nominations either.
The cat was like the Richard Parker of this year for me, except for
Richard Parker.
Unless the Coens had a hefty CG budget that I am unaware of.
Greatest CGI cat ever.
Yeah.
When I go back Baltimore, need no carpet on my floor, you come along and follow me. We'll go down to Galilee. Out in green, green, rocky road, you're promenading green. Tell me who you love, tell me who you love.
Hey, Patches, what was this week's lightning round question?
Yes, it was in honor of Out of the Furnace, which I guess we didn't talk about at all on this podcast. David Fear actually saw Out of the Furnace with us.
It's true.
David, did you like Out of the Furnace?
I did not like it, no. I have a lot of problems with that movie.
I'm the lone defender of that movie. Everyone seems to be caught up in the butt dial, the pivotal moment.
That was a heated discussion after the screening, yes.
The butt dial is among my fewer problems with the movie, but
I just think it's a brooding film. It's good. Christian Bale's good, right? Casey Affleck's good, right?
Nah, they're fine.
Yeah. Sure. Why not?
No one has anything to say on Out of the Furnace. I guess that's...
It's fine. I think the butt dial really didn't bother me, but it bothered me that it was in a script, just like theoretically, like as someone who is in grad school for filmmaking, sitting around a table critiquing people's scripts. Like, there's no way that should have made it past round one.
Sometimes you just need to push the action forward, and sometimes your butt does it.
It's actual use in the movie. I'm like, whatever. You gotta, whatever. It's fine. It's not like it's a butt dial at the end of Lawrence of Arabia that really takes you out of it and ruins the whole thing. The movie is
the remake
really
has that in it. So
no great shakes.
Watch the DVD extras. You'll see the Omar Sharif butt dialing scenes. It's extraordinary.
It's funny because when I interviewed the director, I liken the first scene to Jaws and how it establishes Woody Harrelson as the villain and as the sort of menace under the surface. And he was like, yes, and then used it to talk about how the movie was like The Deer Hunter and The Godfather and all these things. So maybe it isn't that level.
It's been a while since I've seen Jaws. Does the Jaws open with the shark shoving a hot dog in a woman's mouth?
It does. It was in a special edition that was released in theaters.
All these deleted scenes. Man, the classics. They're so different than I remember.
And the shark had a walkie-talkie. It was
Oh, boy. Anyway.
Is revenge in the air because you've got Old Boy coming out one week and then Out of the Furnace the next.
Yep.
And then The Hobbit. They're taking revenge against Smaug. Smaug.
The ultimate revenge
and,
movie.
And Anchorman 2.
Revenge. speaking of revenge, in honor of Out of the Furnace... Our lightning round question is, what's cinema's greatest act of revenge?
David Fear, as our guest, you get to pick your own answer to go first.
You know, it's funny. I've been thinking about this for a half a day, and at first I was like, oh, man, it's got to be the horse's head in the bed and the Godfather, but I don't know that that's an act of revenge so much as a threat. And then I was like, oh, well, when Gloria Graham throws that cup of coffee in Lee Marvin's face in The Big Heat, but it's more shocking when she gets the coffee in her face. So I finally... after much deliberation, came to a scene in a film called Theater of Blood.
Wow.
a beautiful, wonderful, gruesome as hell Vincent Price movie from 1973, in which he is a thespian, a Shakespearean thespian, who is consistently derided by the critics. And so he decides he wants to take revenge on all of these theater critics, these snooty theater critics that have derided him for so many years. Because especially after you hear about the Rotten Tomatoes New York Comic Con thing, like, you know, who doesn't love to deride a critic?
True.
So there's bunches of scenes of him reenacting these violent Shakespearean set pieces on the critics. But my favorite is when he comes across this very effeminate critic played by the late, great Robert Morley, who is in love with his poodles. He is this theater critic who adores these two yappy little poodles that he's got. And so in the spirit of Titus Andronicus, Vincent Price's thespian kidnaps the dogs and forces Robert Morley to eat them in a pie.
Wow.
Oh, revenge. It's not served cold, this dish. It's served piping hot and with dogs inside of it.
I saw about half of this movie on TCM last month when they were showing a lot of Vincent Price stuff. And
oh,
I was like, what is happening? And it was wonderful.
David Fear, are you a big Vincent Price fan?
I am, actually. I came to the whole – I started watching the Corman Poe films when I worked at a video store as I was putting myself through college in the 90s. And I saw Mask of Red Death and kind of fell in love with that. Not just the look of it and how wonderful those Poe adaptations are, but that kind of hammy, over-the-top Vincent Price acting. And ever since then, I've been a huge fan.
Did you like Charlton Copley as Vincent Price in Old Boy?
I liked him as he was playing Goldfinger, yes.
Gold.
So many influences in that performance.
It's so layered.
David, pick one of our listener answers.
Yeah, I'm going to go with Mario Allegre, at Mario Allegre, who says, Kieślowski's White doesn't get mentioned enough in this category. I think White is often and fairly recognized as the bastard chapter of the Three Colors trilogy. The middle chapter always has trouble. Even though the first 30 minutes have like a luminous Julie Delpy and the great marriage sequence. But the movie really does become this weird revenge, ironically black comedy. And it is quite satisfying when all is said and done. So, yeah, White.
Ashes?
I'm going to go with @juvie_cinephile, who said Peck and Paul's Straw Dogs. Arty, icky, beautiful, arguably fascistic revenge. The remake of this movie was really a bore, a tempered version of Peck and Paul's Home Alone. No, I'm kidding.
I think Skyfall is a reference.
Oh, yes. I'm sorry. Skyfall. Skyfall tried and failed again. Nothing can really compete. It's a weird thing to conceive as revenge. I guess it's revenge. They're taking revenge on these people who have tortured them, but it's good fun. Bloody fun. Ugly fun.
I am going with Boomer Knight, who picked a film I'd never even heard of before, but it got me intrigued. Farrah Fawcett in Extremities. I did not know this movie
existed. Is that the full title?
No, the title is Extremities. It's basically a Farrah Fawcett death wish where some guy breaks into her house and tries to rape her, and then she gets revenge and ties him up. And then in the very end, according to the Wikipedia entry, Marjorie forces Joe to admit his guilt by torturing him with the blade, and at one point threatens to castrate him if he does not tell the truth. This movie sounds insane, so maybe...
Farrah Fawcett's Extremities, her only directorial effort. No, I have no idea.
I should mention, because of legal reasons, it actually has to be called Lee Daniels.
After I watch Vincent Price force a guy to eat his poodles in a pie, I might have to watch Extremities, because that sounds like pretty fantastic revenge.
It's a good warm down.
That does it for this week's Fighting in the War Room. We will be back next week with a full slate of new episodes. In the meantime, tell people who you are and where they can find you on the internet, starting with our guest, David Fear.
You can find me on the interwebs on Twitter @DavidLFear. And mostly writing for the Nashville Scene these days. So go to thenashvillescene.com and you can read my reviews of the new Hunger Games films and Old Boy and a couple of other upcoming titles, including possibly Inside Llewyn Davis.
And I am Matt Patches. I write across the internet as well. I'm trying to compile everything at mattpatches.com, but find me on Twitter @MrPatches.
I'm David Ehrlich. I'm the senior editor of film.com. You can find me on Twitter @David Ehrlich and @film.com.
And I'm Katie Rich. You can find me at Vanity Fair's Hollywood blog or on Twitter at Katie Rich, KateyRich. Thank you for listening, and we'll be back talking to you next week.
Down 10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2.
Oh, no.
Oh, please, Mr. Kennedy.
Uh-oh.
I don't want to go.
Please don't shoot me in the outer space. Please.
Oh, please.
Please.
Oh, please.
Please.
Oh, please. Oh, please.
Shoot me off in the outer space.
Oh, please.
Mr. Kennedy.
Oh, please.
Mr. Kennedy.